Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on capital punishment when we come back. You know, with an income tax of $50,000, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed and you pay that 15.3% rate. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of the same $50,000 twice? Now, you know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of the $50,000 first in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. That means that you pay 17% of the $7,650 twice. Now, that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from you and from everyone else that pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears, Penny's, or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? Well, now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, then please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about capital punishment. And I picked a series of treatises that were written by Alan Dershowitz in a book called Contrary to Popular Opinion. You can get a copy of the book. I recommend it. I think you'll really like it. I think you'll find that it's entertaining. It's not only entertaining, it's also informative. He's a rabid, radical, flaming liberal. I'm just the opposite. I'm one of those radical, raving, lunatic, fringe, right-wing conservatives. And when I read, you know, typically articles from some guy, I always call him Goody Two-Shoes, Judy Hartsons, who are trying to tell me that we ought to abolish capital punishment. And I'm all for capital punishment. And I take the opposite view from Mr. Dershowitz, who believes that we should abolish capital punishment. And he makes some good arguments here, and so I've been kibitzing his conclusions and kibitzing his articles from the viewpoint of the scripture, which is why I'm at variance with him, because capital punishment, for instance, was instituted by God himself at Mount Sinai. And this man, being a Jew, we would presume, follows the Old Testament law, the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, and all of the statutes, judgments, and commandments that came out of the mouth of God. Whether he follows Jesus of Nazareth, that's another story, but he should be at least cognizant of all of the law, statutes, and judgments that come out of the Mosaic law. I find when people take this position, I say, well, how come you're not following the law of Moses? And I imagine he's probably got a reason for that, and it's probably his, and he's certainly entitled to his opinion. Now, the reason I'm in favor of capital punishment, and not capital punishment, as I mentioned in the last program, the way it's being carried out in America, because it's really not capital punishment. It's killing. It's retribution. We're getting even. I don't deny that. But capital punishment has two elements to it. Element number one, we want to kill this guy. We want to put him out of circulation. We want to eliminate the problem. And that certainly is accomplished when you kill him, whether you kill him in the secret prison or whether you kill him out on Main Street. But the purpose for this capital punishment, from the perspective of the creator of capital punishment, God Almighty Himself, the reason that we're killing this guy is so that his death becomes an example for everybody else in the community, so that they will hear and fear. He uses that term over and over and over again. So that they will hear and fear. Okay. What he's trying to do is scare the hell out of you. So in the last program, I told you about a big burly guy. He was an oil man from... I can't remember where he's from now. But he was over in Saudi Arabia, worked for Aramco. And he saw two executions over there. One was an execution of a man's hand. They cut his hand off. And the other was the execution of that princess that was killed for adultery over there. She was having an affair with an American. I imagine if they'd have caught the American, they'd probably killed him too. But I don't think they caught him. They caught the female. And so, of course, you know, females, when they get caught practicing adultery, they're whores. When men get caught practicing fornication or adultery, they're studs, you know, like Bill Clinton. Monica Lewinsky, she's a slut. But, you know, Bill Clinton, oh, boy, that's, woo, good old Bill. You know, he's one of the good old boys. Now, in the scripture, the law requires that you take both the man and the woman taken in adultery and you stone them both. But, of course, Christian philosophy over here, they just punish the women, not the men. Now, they didn't get that from the Bible. They got that from their catechisms, or they got that from their religious philosophers or somebody. They didn't get that from God. They didn't get that from Jesus. And so the same thing is true here with capital punishment. This concept of holding these capital killings in secret, and by killing these people with gas and electricity, those aren't executions on the order that was commanded by God, and therefore they don't rise to the level of executions. Vengeance, maybe. But an execution, the other half of the execution, is so that all the rest of us are going to see that, hear it, and we're going to say, oh my God. And that's what this guy told me when he saw that woman being stoned. He said, oh my God, I will never forget that as long as I live. All right, now with that out of the way, last time I couldn't find the word hanged, and it's over here in punishments. Hanged. It's Deuteronomy 21. I had the chapter right, but then I couldn't find the verse. It's chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. And the word hanged is used in the scripture. And I said, you know, I suppose that's where we got the concept of hanging horse thieves or hanging people on the gallows, you know, hanging Captain Kidd. So if you're keeping score here and you have a pen and paper and you want to know where I got that information, I got it from Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. And when you read that statute, you would come to the conclusion that, well, I guess we should take a rope and hang this guy. Should we strangle him when we hang him? Or should we drop him and break his neck? And the answer is no to both. In Joshua 10, verse 26... So jot that one down, Joshua 10:26. And in 2 Samuel 4, verse 12, that's 2 Samuel 4:12, you'll see that the victim, in this case, the guy that's being executed, is killed first, and then he's hung up on a tree, strung up, so that all of the crowd can see the body. You know, otherwise, you know, picture this, you're in Times Square, 10,000 people here, watching the execution. The people in the front ranks are throwing the rocks, and they killed the man, and he's dead. Okay. Well, the people in the back ranks can't see that, so we would take him and we would string him up on the side of an office building up there so that everybody can see him. Now, the statute says you can hang him here, but you got to cut him down and bury him by the end of the day. And this is why the Messiah, you know, after he was hung on the cross, or on the stake, he's actually, I believe it was a stake, he was then taken down and buried before sundown, according to this statute in Deuteronomy 21. So, here, in this case, the Jews were following this law. That's the statute that they were following. So they put him in the grave before sundown that day. And it isn't a hanging. Hanging is not the modality of the killing. Hanging is a part of the execution, but it's not part of the modality of the killing. Stoning is the way this guy has to be killed. Stoning. It can't be done by electrocution, lethal injection, or gas, or dragging him behind a pickup, or in any other mode. It has to be done by stoning. And how do I know that? Well, because that's what God told us. And then he went to the next step and he said, by the way, don't change what I tell you. Do what I tell you. And of course, we see God, at least most people see God as a barbaric savage, an uncivilized barbarian who devised these crazy, off-the-wall concepts over here. And so we got to come along and fix his mistakes. And we've been busy doing that, you know, for many, many years. We've fixed his holy days and we've fixed his executions. And, you know, if there's anything God told us, we're out there busy trying to fix his errors. I just thought I'd come to you and say, well, maybe we don't need to fix as many errors as we thought we did. Maybe he didn't get it as bad or as wrong as we thought he did. So if you want a copy of the book, it's called Contrary to Popular Opinion. It's written by Alan Dershowitz. Well written. Hell of a neat book. I think you're going to like it. You won't agree with it. But I think you're going to like his logic. He comes up with another story called Death Row Inmates Deserve a Lawyer's Aid. Death Row Inmates Deserve a Lawyer's Aid. So let's listen to his argument. He says, Chief Justice William Rehnquist's trigger finger is becoming itchy once again. Every few months, Rehnquist takes to the soapbox, urging the legal system to speed up the process of executing people. Citing the recent execution of serial murderer Ted Bundy, who was not killed until 9 years after his death sentence was imposed. Rehnquist argues that the death penalty appellate process is often chaotic and drawn out unnecessarily. Rehnquist is correct in pointing to the chaotic nature of the process, but he fails to note that he himself is primarily a villain to this drama of death. In 1974, Rehnquist wrote an opinion declaring that a defendant, even on death row, has no right to an appointed lawyer after the first appeal. Since a defendant is entitled to a federal review of constitutional claims, indeed 40% of all death sentences are reversed by federal courts. I didn't know that. I'm going to repeat that to you again. That is very important. 40% of all death sentences are reversed by federal courts. My God, that's 4 out of 10. When I saw that number, I got to sit here and scratch my head. I can't say Dershowitz is wrong. I'm going to just presume that he's correct. You know, 85% of defendants are guilty. 15% are innocent. In rape cases through DNA, we now see that 30% of rape convictions are bogus. They're false. 30% of the people, 30% of the men on or in prison for rape are innocent. And yet there was a woman that pointed to him in front of a jury and said, "That's the man right there that raped me." 3 times out of 10, she's wrong. In this case, 40% of all death sentences are reversed by federal courts. The Rehnquist ruling means that many death row inmates do not have a lawyer during the most critical phases of their case. Even if the defendant seeks review by the U.S. Supreme Court, that court will not appoint a lawyer for him on his petition for review called certiorari. I remember a particularly poignant example of this refusal in a case involving two young boys who were on Arizona's death row because they were held legally responsible for murders committed by their father after they helped him escape from prison. They wrote a letter to the Supreme Court asking it to appoint an attorney for them, and at this critical state in our appeals, the letter said, "Neither Ricky nor I finished high school, and we do not have the education that it would take to carry our appeals to this court. So we beg you, your honors, to please appoint us an attorney, or a lawyer." They did not understand why anybody charged with a minor crime like stealing a bicycle could have a lawyer appointed, but why we, convicted of murder and sitting on death row, facing execution for murders that we had nothing to do with, cannot have a lawyer appointed. Now, the Supreme Court clerk's office responded, telling the boys that the Supreme Court does not appoint lawyers to assist litigants in the preparation of petitions for writs of certiorari in any case. All defendants get lawyers appointed at trial and on the first appeal, but not thereafter. The clerk suggested that the boys write to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People or the American Civil Liberties Union. Eventually, I took their case to the Supreme Court, and certiorari was granted. The case is still in litigation. More than 10 years after the sentencing, not because of any delays on the part of the lawyers, but because the issues are complex and the courts have had them under consideration for all of that time. The major reasons for unnecessary delays do not result from the presence of lawyers, but rather from the absence of lawyers in a good many death cases. As many as one-third of the approximately 2,000 people currently on death row do not have lawyers actively litigating their cases. Lawyers begin to become active on the eve of execution, and then they often have to make up for years of inaction. Lawyers help the court sort through the issues, separating the wheat from the chaff. Now, without the help of lawyers, the desperate death row inmates simply throw darts in the dark, raising some issues that are totally worthless, and failing to raise other issues that are meritorious. This complicates and delays the process unnecessarily. The best way to avoid unnecessary delays in capital cases is to provide for competent counsel from the day of arrest to the day of execution. I've got to pause here and make a comment. I can't contain myself. Competent counsel? You know, Jerry Spence complains of the same thing. He said that when he goes out on the road and he's out here talking to lawyers, he said most of the lawyers, that's half or more, most of the lawyers, don't know how to write a simple brief. They're incompetent. That's Jerry Spence. Here's another lawyer who is competent, says these people need competent counsel. And yet, in this series of articles over here, he points to the ineffective counsel. Ineffective counsel. Look at the first story. Defense of retarded man failed him. The retarded man didn't bring his argument to the courts. The man had a lawyer when he was in the murder trial. How come he didn't advance his defense then? No, boys and girls, the Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger said 90% of the trial lawyers in America are incompetent. I agree. I'm a law school teacher myself. I find the same thing. I agree. I think that the lawyers are incompetent. Now, that doesn't mean all lawyers are incompetent. Many of them are. Very competent. But you got 2,000 people on death row that are going to be represented free of charge. Those inmates, by and large, don't have any money. They're not going to be paying for this. And the state doesn't want to pay for it. And the Supreme Court doesn't have a budget to pay for it. So he raises a valid argument. I agree with his argument over here, but where in hell are you going to get all these competent people to go out here and represent them? Every week somebody writes me a letter from prison, you know, sometimes there's more than that, and they say, Mr. Gordon, will you take my case? My God, man, I can't take all those cases. There's not enough hours in the day for me to do that. And then 85% of the people that are in jail belong there. Held or guilty. I work with a civil rights class here. We teach civil rights here at the law school. My conclusion is what you need to do is to teach the fellow who is the most interested in the case. That's the defendant. Teach him how to go argue his case pro se. I can teach a novice law in about 2 weeks. There's 28 things that you need to know. Now, of course, if you've got an IQ of 53, I don't think you can learn it in 2 weeks. But if you've got an IQ of 105 or 120, you know, your average guy, I mean, 2 weeks' time, you can learn how to how to go into court and represent yourself. I can give you the paperwork. I can show you what you need to know. Then it's a matter of, can you apply yourself and learn this? Can you take your time, effort, and energy and learn how to do this? I've been doing it for years. I think that the solution to this problem of ineffective counsel is to produce effective counsel in the people who have the greatest interest in the case. These two boys in prison. If you would let me into the prison, if you would let my materials into the prison, we could educate these two boys to write their appellate brief. Even if they haven't graduated from high school, they can learn how to write an appellate brief to the Supreme Court. They can go into the Supreme Court and say, here, let me bring up the legal arguments. They can learn how to do legal research. They can go pick up a Supreme Court report and look up the case and read it. Now, it's true that they're unable to because they're ignorant, and here's the system over here as we watch the system as it's unfolding. So I agree with Dershowitz on this point over here. The best way to avoid unnecessary delays in capital cases is to provide for competent counsel from the day of arrest to the day of execution. I have never met a public defender who was competent. There might be some out there, but I haven't met one. And I've run across quite a few. They're just, for by and large, just about as dumb as a box of rocks. They don't have experience. They don't have motivation. They don't have the time. The average load on a public defender is 28 cases. And the American Bar Association says that a top-notch attorney like Mr. Dershowitz can only handle 12 cases a year. That's one a month. And the average public defender is already defending 28 cases. I read about one lawyer one time had 80 cases plus. Now, what kind of representation do you think you're getting? How much time do you think your lawyer is spending on your case working on what needs to be done to represent you when he's got 79 other clients? Now that's nonsense. I can't handle 12 cases simultaneously. I see myself, and I'm not nearly as competent as Dershowitz. I can handle about 3 cases simultaneously at the same time. 3. That's it. Now, where the American Bar Association came up with the idea that they thought that that an average lawyer could handle 12 cases at a time, I don't know. I don't know where that came from. Where Dershowitz is going to get competent counsel for these people from the trial to the Supreme Court. Good luck, partner. So he goes on, next statement over here. He says, no death row inmate should ever be without a lawyer. Death row is the emergency ward of our legal system, and it is a continuing scandal that there are not enough lawyers in the most over-lawyered society in the history of the world to attend to those who most need legal help. Chief Justice Rehnquist finally seems to be recognizing that lawyers may be a help rather than a hindrance to this game plan of speeding up executions. He is now proposing some broadening of the right to counsel for death row inmates. In the end, the reason why it takes so long to execute a condemned criminal is because of the awesome finality of execution. We must be certain that every doubt has been laid to rest along with the inmate's remains. There's no second chance to undo an injustice. In assessing the time between conviction and execution, it must be recalled that the condemned person is not at liberty. He remains in prison. He's on death row. His punishment does not begin with the execution. It ends with the execution. Indeed, a sentence of death, by its very nature, is a sentence of lengthy imprisonment followed by execution. Chief Justice Rehnquist should not be inciting courts into taking shortcuts to execution. His job is to defend the Constitution, not to lead the mob demanding quick death. I think Rehnquist is correct. I think that these death row cases, capital cases that take years and years, like Ted Bundy, 9 years. Why does it take 9 years to execute a mass murderer? You see, the problem that you have here is justice delayed is justice denied. And there's a disconnect between the crimes. For instance, by the time Bundy goes to the execution chamber, His crimes are totally forgotten. Nobody can remember the name of a single victim. Nobody can remember the circumstances under which that victim died. That's the disconnect. Let me give you an illustration. Here in the Bible, there's a guy that breaks the Sabbath day. It's early on in the story here in Exodus. And they just came out of Egypt. I mean, they're out in the wilderness. They haven't been out there very long, a couple, 3 months. And then this guy's Sabbath day. Now, this guy's out gathering sticks on the Sabbath. This is an activity that this guy has probably been engaged in all of his life. He's lived in Egypt, and he's used to hard work. He's been a slave, you know, all of his life. And so it's Saturday, and so he's out gathering sticks to build a fire. And so he's caught gathering sticks, and so they bring him to Moses, and they said, "Hey, we caught this guy out here gathering sticks." Sounds like Judy Hartson saying, "Look what we found. He's out gathering sticks." Now, this guy had an opportunity. He walked through the Red Sea. He was baptized in the Red Sea, in the crossing. He saw the walls of water on each side. He saw the cloud, the pillar of cloud. He saw the pillar of fire. He saw the destruction of the Egyptian army. And this guy was an eyewitness. He was actually there. You know, you and I, we're reading this in the Bible. And, you know, we're sitting there going, I'll bet, Okay, but this guy was actually there. He saw this happen. He was there on the day when God himself, on top of the mountain, came back and said, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." He heard the Ten Commandments. He knew what the law was. He heard it from the lawgiver himself. And he heard what the penalty was. Now, he had never seen anybody actually killed for Sabbath breaking. But he did hear, but he didn't fear. He heard, but he didn't really take it to heart. Now, he's out doing his normal thing, like most people do. They're walking the dog on Saturday. They're going to work on Saturday. They're going shopping at the mall on Saturday, doing what he's normally been doing. He's caught violating the law. This is a capital felony. So they bring him in to Moses. And they make a determination that, yes, indeed, he has broken the Sabbath. Now, to do that, you have to have two witnesses. So you go to Deuteronomy 19, verse 15, and there's a statute that says, in the event that somebody accuses you of a crime at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. So we're not taking hearsay. We're not taking this at the mouth of some vindictive jerk who says, "Well, I don't like old Tom over here, so I'm going to accuse him of rape." Or like women do oftentimes, "Well, I don't like that guy, he jilted me, so I'm going to accuse him of date rape or something. I'm really going to get him in trouble." This just happened the other day. You know, there was three guys over here in North Carolina. Three or five guys on a wasn't a football team, I don't know, playing cricket or something, or some kind of a crazy game. Anyway, it was at Duke University, and these two whores, jumping up out of a cape, you know, they accused these three or four guys of rape when in fact it was totally bogus. That kind of thing goes on all the time. So God says, listen, we got to have witnesses here. Rape typically doesn't have two or three witnesses. Just wanted to point that out to you. And so we have 30% of the rape victims are the men who are accused of rape, not the women. And it's the men who are falsely imprisoned. See, we didn't know that until we had DNA. Come on. So in order to prevent that, you got to have two or three witnesses. So Moses is looking for witnesses. They come up with the three witnesses. The guy admits he's been gathering sticks on the Sabbath. So they go into the temple. They go into the tabernacle. They haven't built the temple yet. They go into the tabernacle, this big tent, and they ask God, who's sitting on the mercy seat, you know, at this time, "Well, what should we do with this guy?" And so God says, "Kill him. Take him out and stone him." Pretty damn heavy duty, isn't it? First time offender. He's been doing this on Saturday all of his life. He's never practiced the Sabbath before. This is a new program. He's the first guy to ever break the Sabbath. And what's the penalty? Death. How long did it take? It took him out the same day. Stoned him to death. Now that's a connecting link. That's pretty well connected, wouldn't you say? We caught him 3 or 4 days ago. They put him in ward. They locked him up in somewhere. And then they brought him out, tried him, came to the conclusion, came to the determination that yes, he was guilty, and took him out and executed him the same day. There's no disconnect between the crime, the victim, the execution. No disconnect at all. Everybody can see that. And they have to participate in the execution. They had to listen to the thud of the rock hitting this guy. Now that guy will come up in the second resurrection, what's known as the Great White Throne Judgment, discussed in Ezekiel 37 and Isaiah 65 and Revelation 20. And he'll live again. He'll have his opportunity again. But that was pretty final. Now when Dershowitz raises this issue and he says 40% of these death row convictions are reversed in federal court. You know, I haven't checked that number personally, so I'm putting the number out there. I'm relying on Mr. Dershowitz here. It's in his book. He's a law school professor. I presume he looked it up. I presume he knows what he's talking about. That is shocking. And I agree. We need to make damn sure that this guy is in fact guilty of the crime. What if we were taking all of these rapists? Now, the punishment for rape is death. In the scripture, rape, death. We would be killing one third of all of the convicted rapists under our present system. So I'm with Dershowitz on this. I don't think that we should be using this system to make these determinations. And when he says we should abolish the death penalty, I think that he is reaching a conclusion from insufficient facts. I think that we should kill rapists. I think that incest ought to be punished by death. I think that murder should be punished by death. But I think that we should make sure that the guy that did the crime is the guy that dies, not some guy that's innocent. And what that means is that sometimes we can't prove that this guy killed that woman. Sometimes we can't prove that this guy is the rapist, which means we got to turn him loose. That's the bottom line. Better to turn a guilty man loose than to convict and then punish an innocent man. Now that's the principle of the scripture. Now I got to take a break here and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the internet daily. Now for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools total. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and we're open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about capital punishment. Now, the governor of Illinois here last year or year before suspended executions in Illinois because they'd found that the system there in Illinois had convicted two or three innocent people. They later, you know, found that these guys were innocent. I think it's fairly reasonable to withhold the death penalty in those cases where circumstantial evidence is used to draw a conclusion and where there is some doubt as to whether or not this guy's guilty. Dershowitz brings up a good point. You know, once you've killed the guy, I mean, that's, and then we find out he's innocent later, you know, it's too late. Now, God is very, very insistent that you follow every precept of his principles here. And if we do that, we will not execute anybody. None. Zero zilch. No innocent people will get killed. Now, when you confess to a crime, even if you're innocent, and you confess to a crime, then you're a false witness. And the penalty for a false witness is whatever it was you thought to do to the other guy, the guy you're testifying against, is what we're going to do to you. So there's a case where a guy came up to King David and he said, I killed King Saul. He actually hadn't killed King Saul. He was killed in battle, or he killed himself. But he happened upon the king's body. And he said, if I go to King David and I tell him, hey, I killed your enemy, King David will give him a big reward. So he rushes over to the king. He says, hey, I've got King Saul over here and I killed him and I'm looking for a reward. And King David said, what did you say? And this guy said, well, I killed your enemy, King Saul. And so David, who is now a king over a part of the kingdom, he didn't have all of it yet. He after King Saul died, he took it all. But, you know, up until this time, he had a following. He said, put this man in irons. And he said, take him out and slay him. And he used this term. He said, out of your own mouth have you condemned yourself. And the reason for that was is that the king is anointed by God. And this guy went out and killed the king's anointed one. King David had three opportunities to kill King Saul, live and direct and personal. And he did not do that. And he didn't do it because that was King Saul, God's anointed. And it came from 1 Samuel chapter 8. He understood the law, and he didn't take the law into his own hands and play vigilante and go out here and kill Saul. He waited patiently until Saul was killed in battle. God killed him. This is called an act of God. Now, this story here is pretty interesting to me because I read the book. These two boys, let me tell you the background of these two boys. Their daddy is locked up in the Arizona State Penitentiary. And for a good long time, their daddy was a criminal. And he was locked up legitimately, and he belonged in prison because he was, in fact, a robber, a rapist. It wasn't rape. I think he was a robber, an armed robbery or something. But whatever it was, he was locked up for a good long time. Now, he's going to be in prison now for 30 years. And he's got a wife, and he's got these two children, and it's a pretty nice family, and they're broken up now, and they're all sad because dad's in prison, and so the dad starts talking to the wife and the two boys about helping him break out of prison. And he breaks out of prison with the help of his two teenage sons and his wife with a couple other guys. And during the escape, I forgot exactly how the story went, but they stole a car and then they got out in the desert and they found these people out here in the desert and they stole their car and they killed them. So here's the two teenage boys. They helped their daddy escape from prison. You know, they brought him the key to the cell, or they brought him the cake with the saw blade in it, or whatever it was they did. I've forgotten now exactly how they helped him break out. But there was no doubt that these two boys and the mother helped the husband and father break out of prison. But these three people did not kill anybody. But the state of Arizona, and many states do this, the state of Arizona has a statute on the books. And it says, in effect, if you are a party to a crime, if you're a co-conspirator in a crime, and out of that criminal act or activity, somebody gets killed, well, then we're going to prosecute you for murder as well. I mean, that's the statute, that's the way it is. Now, that is unscriptural. That violates the law of God. In the scripture, under the statute of murder, it says, the man who sheds the blood, his blood shall be shed. If we use the principle of the lawmaker is the law, in other words, the law is characterized or made by the lawmaker, or the intent of the law, it comes from the lawmaker. If God had intended for the co-conspirators to die as well, or to be equally guilty, he would have added that clause in one of the statutes. He did not do that. Then, to make it even clearer that the sons are not to be punished for the sins of their fathers, we have a section over here in Ezekiel chapter 18. The actual application of this principle of law, God has not failed us here. He comes to the fore and he says in chapter 18, he says, if a man be just and do that which is lawful and right, and has not eaten upon the mountains, and neither has lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, neither has defiled his neighbor's wife, neither has come near to a menstruous woman, has not oppressed any, but has restored to the debtor his pledge, has spoiled none by violence, has given his bread to the hungry, has covered the naked with a garment, he that has not given forth upon usury, neither has taken any increase, that has withdrawn his hand from iniquity, has executed true judgment between a man and a man, and has walked in my statutes, and has kept my judgments to deal truly, he is just, he shall surely live, says the Eternal. All right, now, if you're righteous and you practice the Ten Commandments, and you obey God and keep his commandments, you practice his 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, you live by his 133 principles or statutes or titles of law, you're just, you shall live. In fact, that'll guarantee you 25,550 days. Guaranteed. Under the terms of the contract. Otherwise, we got a wrongful death action. Against God, no less. All right. Now, with that in mind, he goes on a step further. In verse 10, he says, now, if he begets a son that is a robber, a shedder of blood, and that does the like to any one of these things, and that does not any of those duties, but even has eaten upon the mountains, defiled his neighbor's wife, has oppressed the poor and the needy, has spoiled by violence, has not restored the pledge, has lifted up his eyes to the idols, has committed abomination, has given forth upon usury, has taken increase, shall he then live? He shall not live. He has done all these abominations. He shall surely die, and his blood shall be upon him. All right, so now, if you're a wicked fellow, and you go out and you violate these laws, and many of these laws here, all these laws here, are capital felonies. You know, he's not talking about, you know, parking tickets here, you know, or you know, shoplifting. He's talking here about heavy-duty idolatry and adultery and so on. And he says, shall he live? No, you got a righteous man, yes, he shall. You got a wicked man, he shall not live. Okay, now there's two classifications. Take a look at a third one here. Now, verse 14, now, lo, if he begets, now this is the bad guy, this is the robber, the guy who's in prison. If he begets a son that sees all of his father's sins which he has done, and considers, and doeth not such like, that has not eaten upon the mountains, and neither has lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, has not defiled his neighbor's wife, neither has oppressed any, has not withholden the pledge, neither has spoiled by violence, but has given his bread to the hungry, has covered the naked with a garment, that has taken off his hand from the poor, that has not received usury nor increase, has executed my judgments, has walked in my statutes, he shall not die for the iniquity of his father. He shall surely live. As for his father, because he cruelly oppressed, spoiled his brother by violence, and did that which is not good among his people, lo, even he shall die, and he shall die in his iniquity. Yet, say you, why does not the son bear the iniquity of the father? When the son has done that which is lawful and right, and has kept all of my statutes and has done them, he shall surely live. Now, this concept in religious circles of inherited sin is poppycock. And that statute right there knocks in the head these religious ideas of inherited sin. But it goes a step further than that, and it clarifies the duties involved in the sons of a wicked father, which in this case, we got this wicked father, he's in prison, and the children come over here and do a wicked act and help him escape from prison, for which they should be punished. But the father went out and killed somebody. Should they be punished for the killing of the somebody that the father killed? And so in verse 20 says, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. And the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, and neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. But if the wicked shall turn from all of his sins that he has committed, and keep all of my statutes, and do that which is lawful and right, he shall surely live. He shall not die. And all of his transgressions that he has committed, they shall not be mentioned unto him in his righteousness that he has done. He shall live. He goes on to say, have I any pleasure at all that the wicked should die, says the Eternal, and not that he should return from his wicked ways and live? All right, so this is pretty important, because if you'll take a look here at the scriptural principle over here, these two boys should have been prosecuted for escape, for helping somebody escape from prison. No doubt about that. They were guilty of that. Once the father escaped from prison and went out and killed somebody over there, these two boys were not under the terms of the scripture. I mean, the creator of the universe. I mean, the legislators down in Arizona said, God made a mistake, and we're going to fix it. We're going to create our own laws down here, and we're going to lock these boys up, find them guilty, and execute them. In fact, these two boys were on death row when I read the book. Whether they were ultimately executed or not, I don't know. To this day, I don't know. But I remember reading the story. Now, Alan Dershowitz defended these two boys over here, and I don't know if he came up with an answer to this at the end. Let me look at this again. Lawyer's aid. The Tyson brothers were finally spared the death penalty. Oh, okay. They're still in prison, I guess, but they were spared the death penalty. Well, they should be in prison, but not for murder, which is more than likely what they're there for. Probably life in prison for murder. Under the Mosaic law, those boys would have to pay the penalty for their sins, but just for their sins, not the sins of their father. He's the one that killed people. He's the one that paid. Now, the importance of making sure that we get the guilty party is done with the witnesses in Deuteronomy 19:15. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. Now, does that mean we have to have an eyewitness? No. In fact, eyewitnesses are notoriously poor. Take a look at the eyewitnesses who are condemning to prison all of these people for rape that are innocent. I mean, every one of those women pointed to the defendant and said, that's the man that raped me. And there's a modality for doing that. And here's the way that ought to be handled. The police, when they get a rape report, they're under pressure. They're under pressure from the mayor, from the chief of police, from the press, from the victim, from the victim's family. Are you going to find this guy or not? Well, now the police, you know, when you walk into the police station and say, hey, I've been raped, you know, they don't have any more idea who raped you than you do. So don't blame the policeman. He doesn't know. So he says, well, sit down here and give me a report. Give me some information. Give me something to go on. So he says, where did this happen? When did this happen? Why did this happen? What did this guy look like? Now, oftentimes, these rapists will have a mask over their face. Or maybe the rapist is doing this in the dark. And maybe the victim did not get a good look. And so it's pretty hard to prove rape, you know, when you can't identify the rapist. In fact, it's nigh on to impossible. Not exactly impossible, but, you know, nigh on to. And so the next step comes along, and so let's assume that the policeman, he says, okay, well, let's take you in for a medical examination. So they're looking for semen in this woman's vagina so that they can get a DNA sample. Now we've got something to go on. So now, you know, a little time later, maybe we find some guy, and he matches this DNA sample. Now, this woman can't point to this guy and say, that's the rapist. But she can certainly testify that I was raped. And I was raped by a man. And I was raped by a man that was about 5'6" or 5'8". Maybe she could even identify his race. Maybe she could say it was a black man. It was a Hispanic man. It was an Oriental man. It was a white man. I mean, you know, you could get the race down. We could get his sight or his height down. And then the DNA that comes out of her, the doctor can testify, yep, that's the sample we got, and yep, that's what it tested, and yep, we got this sample from this man, and yep, it matches the sample that's in that woman. And yep, here's the time frame. And now we've got this woman as a witness, now we've got the doctor as a witness, now we've got the forensic expert as a witness, we've got our three witnesses, haven't we? We've got our three witnesses. You know, rapists don't go in very often. There was one case up in, I got to tell you, this is, I think it was in Boston, Massachusetts, when a whole bunch of men, I don't know, five, six, eight guys, gang raped a woman in a pool hall on a pool table in full view of all the rest of the patrons in the place. Now, under the law of God, if we could identify those eight guys that raped that woman on that table, we would take those eight guys out and we would stone them to death. How many repeat events do you think would happen? Well, I guarantee you, those eight guys would never do it again. And I think that if it was a public execution done out here in front of everybody, and you had to participate in it on the Sabbath day, in front of the synagogue, and you had to throw the rocks, I think you'd remember that. And I think that the next time you were in a pool hall, you'd say, oh yeah, I can remember what happened to the eight guys in the pool hall. Now, how long after this rape takes place do we need to carry this out? Now, they get these lawyers involved in this, and it drags on with appeals, and all the rest of this crap goes on. Why do we need an appeal for somebody that we know is guilty? It has to do with the process by which he's being convicted. The process. Now, that's another problem. See, under our Constitution, we have a thing called the Bill of Rights. And let's suppose that the police went into this guy. We're talking about rape now. Let's suppose the police went into this guy's house without a search warrant. Knock this guy down. Beat him up real good. And then take a sample of his body fluids, and then take it in for the DNA sample and find out that, yes, indeed, this is the guy that raped that woman. You see, we have a law here that prohibits that kind of conduct. We have President Bush doing that today. We have a place called Guantanamo, and so we torture these people. You know, we want a confession. So we call it rendition. And if we don't want to torture them ourselves down in Guantanamo, then we ship them off to Egypt or some other country, and we have them tortured over there. Listen, remember this statute over here in Deuteronomy 19:15 that says at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established? That's where we get our Fourth Amendment and Fifth of our Fourth Amendment right to privacy. We have a right to be secure in our person, houses, papers, and effects. That's where that comes from. And then our Fifth Amendment right, we don't have to testify against ourselves. It's at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. Not by the confession that's been beaten out of somebody. So, we have a process that we have to go through. Now, once we go through the process, and let's presume now that this happened over in England, they went through a whole community and they took samples from all the men in this local community. And then one of the samples matched. And then that's the rapist and that's the man they went after. I don't have any objection to doing that. If there was a rape here in Isabella and they said, okay, we want a sample from every man here in the community, I would step up and say, I didn't rape that woman and I'm perfectly willing to give a sample. Now, our Constitution prohibits you requiring me to give the sample. You can't make me do it. So all of us good citizens in the community that didn't do the rape step up, and there's only two guys left. maybe one guy or two guys or three guys that say, well, I'm not going to give the sample. Okay, well, then that tells us all the rest of us are innocent. So now we know who to zero in on, don't we? So now we can zero in our investigation on the two or three guys that are left. That's the way the English did it. And I don't have any objection to Walmart putting RFID tags in their merchandise to prevent shoplifting. But boy, I get real upset about RFID tags in my property when I walk out of that store. Because see, once I've paid you for a partner, that's mine. And I don't want your damn RFID tag in my property. Get it out. So the RFID tag should not be concealed in the goods that I'm taking home. That violates my Fourth Amendment right. I don't like that. But we have processes, and these processes come from the Mosaic Law. The Fourth and Fifth Amendment, boys and girls, come from the Bible. It comes from the law of God. It does not come from the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. It doesn't come from the Patriot Act or Homeland Security. It comes from the Ten Commandments. It comes from these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. And Dershowitz, now being a civil libertarian, is adamant about following the process, following the rules of the game. And oftentimes the police do not do that. And so he's got a story in here. In his arguments concerning capital punishment that deal with technicalities, which we'll take up next time, and following the rules. And the court should be adamant about following the rules that favor the police and the investigators and the citizenry in uncovering crime and apprehending criminals. I'm all for that. I'm all for that. I'm not here advocating crime at all. But I'm also a very adamant civil libertarian that we ought not to be running around here acting like George Bush in Guantanamo practicing rendition under the Patriot Act. I'm opposed to that. That's criminal behavior. That violates the law of God. It violates the law of our Creator. And if we followed capital punishment the way it was given to us by God Himself, we wouldn't have this problem. Our problem is we don't practice capital punishment. We practice vengeance, and we call it capital punishment. All right, so much for that part of the story. Let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.